and tribal man, which is the clan, nation, all four live in a peculiar form of horizon. They live under four separate horizons, and he could state very simply the qualities of these four horizons. The tribe looks backward. Israel looks forward. The empire creates a mere presence, a cyclical presence, that has neither past nor future, but eternal presence. And Greece creates a poetical world of comparisons and metaphors, in addition to the existing world. That is humanism. Now, in these four ways, the ancients divided themselves up, and so do to this day all the pagans, all the heathens, who either are tribal, like the Irish, or who either are imperial, as the Japanese, or who are great, as the whole professions and all the college people, or the prophetics like the Jehovah Witnesses or the genuine Christian church, the church people. But every one of you knows also that in our era we feel free to emphasize one or the other of any of these aspects. You came here this moment, still, I don't know how long in this country, prophetic man and God's country and clannishness minorities. And science, the Greek one. And you can shift between the four, and you can have all these qualities, therefore, in your own life, under the Christian cross, in alternation, that you can cure one by the other. And that is the difference between our era and antiquity. The Christian era, in order to do this, had to absorb the ways of old. Christianity comes when the times are fulfilled. That is, when all the possible ways of the human spirit have been walked out. The times of the as you read in the New Testament is not an empty phrase. It means that men once had walked out all possibilities. The Empire State Building is nothing compared to the pyramids. The pyramids that have been built by Christ comes. Modern families are absolutely nothing to the loyalty of Fiji in Ravenna that has been done. What are the modern prophets compared to Isaiah and Jeremiah? Small fire. The prophets to this day are in combat. And what is modern art compared to Homer or Greek tragedy or Greek philosophy? Very small. The only floundering, the only handicap of these ancients is that they couldn't get out of their own dead-end streets, you see. That they were once forever what they were. Once a Chinese, always a Chinese. Once a Greek, always a Greek. Once a tribesman, always a tribesman. And once a Jew, always a Jew. And how true this is, you see, from the fact that to this moment, the people in philosophy departments and colleges think they have to say Greek. That is, they have to explain God by the nature of things. That still is a Greek mind, comparing everything, comparing all the gods, comparing all the countries, comparing all the literatures. What you learn here, still, gentlemen, to this moment is Greek. And on the other hand, it is only at this moment that Israel receives back its own country can go from one country to another, change allegiance, you see. An Englishman can become an American. But the fate of Judaism for the last 1900 years was still that of the dead end street. And that's only passing before your eyes, gentlemen. Now, at this very moment, when in philosophy, those who have taken other courses really know this, for example, philosophy 10 and 9, where in philosophy itself, the Greek mind is superseded, where man is no longer face to face with nature, as in Greek speaking, where there is not this kind of pick and choosiness of the world around us. Because even the existentialists today discover that man's own mind is in change, is in flux, and that his soul therefore has to have other certainties than just comparisons and systems and pluralisms and humanistic attitudes. The existentialists, you see, are the first philosophers who are not humanists. Therefore, today begins the end of Greece and the end of Israel before your very eyes. To this day, gentlemen, the Christian era had not been able to completely redeem the Greek mentality and the Jewish soul, the Jewish prophecy. This is happening, it's a great event in the history of mankind, that the Christian era at this moment only is allowed to absorb these two features. And it happens in this manner, gentlemen, that the humanist at this first moment is forced in his own mind, you see, to see the temporality of his thinking. That his own thinking is not out of pride, country, or Israel, out of past, future, or present, you see, not in another world, facing objects, but that the subject of the mind, the creator of the poetical world of Greece, you see, himself still has a heart which must beat with decision and determination in a certain time. In other words, gentlemen, at this moment, the so-called existential philosophers redeem Greece. Redeem in the sense of the New Testament that they reconcile it, they bring it home, they take it out of its own dead end street and bring it back to the unity of the human, of human life. The same is true of the Jews. The same is true of the empires. We saw, I mentioned already, that in 1911 the Chinese emperor fell. In 1917 the Russian emperor. In 1918 the Austrian-Hungarian and the German emperor. In 1947 the emperor, king of England, gave up his title as emperor of India. So how many empires? And the Mikado, of course, has declined to be really the Mikado in the old sense anymore, and of MacArthur's divine supervision. And so you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 empires when during the last 30 years. Great Britain in India, Russia, Austria-Hungary, Germany, China, Japan. Quite a list. That's much more important, gentlemen, than the whole world of our union. 6 empires where that shattered. And even the king of Italy gave up his title as emperor until now. So a tiny, tiny little empire was in the history, but also shared the 1944. So 7 empires were shared. Why do you look so serious? So the Emperor Jones is the last one, and that's a plague. And the same is true, of course, of the tribes, gentlemen. We watch today the disintegration of the family. And the reason for the disintegration of the family can be stated in very simple terms. The word family becomes meaningless because family is taken as meaning the word of familiating together, as working together. The married couple and their children are ceasing to be the cooperative team, the unit of work, the tin can and the sandwich box have replaced that. And that means that the members of a family work at different places. And that's a tremendous revolution that which places for the first time the relations of children and parents outside the field of organized society. That is now, as one has said, a bundle of people who don't fit together and who cram each other aside. Because for their work, they go on each other, get on each other's nerves. Anybody who comes home from work has a special environment in him and on with him. And if you come home and you suddenly find people who work the famous idea what you have been through during the last 8 hours, in your office, and you have a very hard time to make yourself understood in everything. There's no member of the family now on the receiving end. Just being able to listen to the other people's talks. Everyone has to talk, including the housewife. So the pictures don't make them listen. There is no longer the family that in the old sense, because the word family, as I told you, that means those who are nourished by one bread. I think I told you this. Who are nourished by one food. Who are therefore forming one body, because one food builds them up every day. And one food builds them only up every day because they work together for this food. But it's a school lunch. In our town, they collect money for charity for the school lunch, which is incredible. That is, the parents are no longer expected to pay for the school lunch of their children. Now, whatever these people who do this collecting think what they are doing by collecting the money for the school lunch, they certainly are the most radical communists I've ever seen. I doubt that the things have gone that far for everybody. This is fortunate, if anything is fortunate. But here, it all moves over. We live in a country of free enterprise, supported by subsidies, charities, nationalization, school lunch, etc. I don't know what the truth really is, but the funny thing is that nobody wants to know what's going on in this country. Everybody says we are the qualified against communism. Do you really believe that? This is standardization of manners and morals. I wish you were. So, gentlemen, there's four things then today which are in disappearance. Empires, families, the Greek, superior mind of contemplative philosophy, and the eternity of the Jewish promise, of the messianic hope. The Zionists have given up the messianic hope. The empire have given up the eternal cyclical presence. The Greek mind is beleaguered today by the experience that there is no system of philosophy, because every man lives to himself. And the tribes give up their greatest product, the integrity of the human. which they have been able to create through 7,000 years. Families fed by one food and therefore becoming one flesh every day again. So, gentlemen, this is the victory of the Christian era over the flesh of the victory. These four prizes are, in one way, triumphs. The Christian era has created one world, one God, and one is on the way of creating one society. And it is beginning in the existential philosophy and Kierkegaard and Nietzsche to create medicine men who have the power of the spirit without needing big schools and examinations on certain systematic paragraphs and topics. Nietzsche is the first medicine man, gentlemen, of our Christian era. That is a man who develops extraordinary spiritual powers to perceive the state of affairs of human history. And his authority of Mr. Spengler are only the professors who, so to speak, try to reflect on what Nietzsche has said. That they are very far behind that what really these great men have done. They have lived, and Goethe has lived, and Saint-Simon has lived, somewhat as Marx to a certain extent. But neither Mr. Spengler nor Mr. Tony live it, but they reflect on it. They demonstrate that there is a tremendous need for every man today to be able to shelve old eras in his own life and to enter a new one, conscious deliberately, while he lives his own one life. Because both Mr. Spengler and Mr. Tony invited to be with them power, able to bury one's revelation and start another. But don't mistake these people, these literary planters, Mr. Tony and Mr. Spengler are there, deserving people, but they do not rank as the people who, for the first time, gentlemen, serve in a human society and no longer in the exploration of the world of space. Because now I take the second step, gentlemen, I try to sum up to you what are his distinctions in our era from the past. We either have one God or no God today. The only question today is between people who believe in God and don't believe in God. Up to this time, there has always still been the question between the true God and the false God. There were simply heathens, there were still the Japanese and the Buddhists. But the real question today is only between people who believe in the living God and people who don't believe in God at all. Atheism and theism are the only things left. In other words, gentlemen, the oneness of God is accepted. No atheist spokesman has the oneness of God. The only thing there is no God. But that's not the issue, gentlemen, down to 1900 for the missionary. The missionary comes to a place where there are witchcraft and sorcerers and ghosts and demons and sky gods, you see. And he has to lay those factors. The church here is a world of many gods and has done the existence of God. Today, however, there's only the question of the God or no God. One God or no God. That is the antithesis, gentlemen, of our era to antiquity is many and one. The antitheses in our own era are always one against another one. Yes. That is, The question has been one world or many worlds. The scientific progress element of the second millennium has sold to you as Americans the idea as your birthright that there's only one natural world, that there is no room for divine rights of kings, that there are no sacred cows in the Ganges River, that there is no Rome or Jerusalem which in any way is exempt from the laws of gravity and nature, that geography is all-pervading, and that the laws of nature permeate all space, gentlemen. We take today the oneness of space for granted against the manyness of temples, which is the imperial situation, yes? An empire is a place with a special sky and special privileges of the sky over it. Still, the emperor of Russia would say we have to get Constantinople, because that's where the sacred anointment of the first emperor of the East took place. Now, the Bolsheviks can live quite happily without Byzantium, as it seems. And Constantinople no longer is a real issue. It may come one way or the other, but it will not alter the character, the consecration of the Bolshevik government. You can see today that the turnover of the Tsaristic government changed their relation to space. The Bolsheviks proudly say we form 1/6 of the globe. That is, they refer the boundaries of their domination to the whole of the globe, to the oneness of space. If, as soon as you say 1/7, 1/6, what do you do? What's your assumption? What's your basic? This is the oneness. And that is the real best contribution I think the Russians have made spiritually to the world, life of the world, during the last 30 years. That they have said that they contain 1/6 of the Earth's area and space. That's a new thing that had never been said before. That the government voluntarily gave up its local name. You see, they don't call themselves in their official title Russia anymore, but USSR means United Soviet Republics. And that is, I think, all to the good, because it suddenly disanchors, how do you say? Can you say disanchors? And anchors the government in under one special sky. You can see this very neatly in the fact, gentlemen, that the Russian Tsars, since Peter the Great, all had Greek names. There was Alexander, Paul, Nicholas, Constantine, which means that they all tried to go back to the sacred empire of Rome in the 2,500 years ago. The last Tsar, what was his name? Nicholas. So you see, the names of the Russian empires themselves contain the element of imperialistic, you see, sacredness. And if an American is down on imperialism, gentlemen, let you kindly be very distinct on this. We live in a new world in which there are no empires, and in which there are no sacred boundaries for empires. But as to the purpose of the whole world and organization, we certainly are imperialists. So if you use the word imperialist, distinguish the religious character of the empire has collapsed in the world revolution of the two world wars. Will you take this term? The religious character of empire has collapsed. And the American tradition is to go against this religious connotation of empire. But we have nothing against the empire state. Our instinct is not away when we speak there of empire builders. Because they are builders in a very secular sense. So I think the first thing you should do in your self-education is to watch yourself as to your reaction to the word empire. business of temperament, of cult, and contains element of worldly organization. And you can't dismiss both with one shrug of the shoulder.
Hold out and have faith and courage. In any family, that's true. If one person has a breakdown, the
Christianity, sir, what men atheists, fellowship, theists. Atheism ignores the conditions of churchhood, of ecclesiasticism, of fellowship, of friendship, of family life, and therefore puts the whole burden on one gentleman. If you try to seek out God all by yourself, you must end an atheist. Because nobody in his five senses can proclaim that he does believe in God 24 hours a day. He very often is smart, he very often is cunning, he very often is not really believing in God's providence. And don't be ashamed of admitting it. It's an old story. Jesus prayed in Gethsemane, Father, let this chance, if you can, go by. I mean, he had not absolute faith. But he wrestled with the angel, so did Jacob. All the great saints have had their temptation, their moment in which they just couldn't find the Lord. Now, it is high time that you drop all these childish fears of discussing these very central problems of your own historical position, gentlemen. Because when you try to find whether you believe in God or not, the old first discussion makes that you believe at times and at other times you don't. But then you have to go further and investigate what can strengthen your faith. And your faith can be strengthened by love, faith, and open fellowship. And it is when once you isolate yourself in your pride and try to figure it all out by yourself. So, gentlemen, there is a tremble of religion all the time. The pagan in you is what it is. The Jew in you is in God. And he says to you that the greatest burden is in Judaism. Even though he slay me,
being admitted, that is false.
position of one has always been that the world is the devil's, and God and men must both together fight the world. Today's the wrong verse. Today's the idealism that the world is a wonderful place. It seems to come all every day from the search for the world. I can't understand more than I can. You want me to well understand what I have. It is true that the undertaker who governs our churches thinks that the blood of the cemetery make wonderful sense. That's the orientation which is given to the congregation. The cemetery can be organized, but the world is still chaos. If you read it, Bertrand Russell is fully aware of this fact. Modern mathematics and modern natural science begin to realize, as you know, that all is just a law of chance and probability, and not a law of direction and law of order. Natural laws today are declared to be merely averages of chaos. So then we have three positions here. The central position is the one you are present and addicted to. That's ideal. The world is true and beautiful. This is our political situation. You see what's in here. It's geopolitics. Every part of the world has its own rights and powers over men, spirit, and heart. And the third position, I think, is the sober position. And it is the position of the newest natural philosophy, gentlemen. Now, I told you already that at this moment, the last vestiges of pre-Christian traditions vanish. The third millennium of our era, gentlemen, is that strange millennium in which the fight is inner Christian, inside our era, and in which all pre-Christian vestiges go. For this reason, idealism must go today. Idealism assumes that the world is a good place, that is a normal order by itself. That's the Greek idea. Now, the latest natural scientists, gentlemen, Mr. Planck and Einstein are Christians in their scientific mentality. So is Bertrand Russell, so is Whitehead. So are the genes heading are making a beginning. So is Schrödinger, so are Heisenberg. Why are these scientists the real missionaries of Christian thinking today? Well, for the simple reason that they dismiss the Greek dogma, you see, that the world can be judged to be good and orderly by the mind. The Greek assumption is just this, that the world is to be treated idealistically, as an ideal is. And these modern scientists, gentlemen, do the same as the Zionists who found the Jewish state. The Zionists dismiss the prophetic monopoly of Israel and leave the prophetic tradition to all men. Since they become our specialists of the Jewish state of Israel, you and I, gentlemen, are the only executors of the will of the Old Testament. In the same way, gentlemen, the Greek school, the Greek academy, the academic tradition of the West, has been this far, I said this already of the existentialist, remember, that the mind could create an ideal world. Now the existentialist says there is no such thing as this mind that can create an ideal world. And the scientists say, the physicists, the world is not ideal. So the existentialist, gentlemen, and the physicists, they get together on both ends of the problem. The object is undermined and exploded in the Greek sense, you see, as being chaos and being merely probable. And the subject is exploded by the existentialists, by Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, who in their own life simply have lived the truth. Goethe, by the way, too. The truth then such a mind does not exist. The mind that can stabilize the world, you see, in a permanent manner. This is, I think, you should be excited. So you see, the American position today is strangely mixed. Most Americans try to be idealists and they are theists at the same time. They say that they are Christians, you see. And they do not say that in as far as they are idealists and say that the world is good, that this world of space has a natural inclination to go in shape, so to speak, you see. That there they are not Christians at all, but just idealists. Now, gentlemen, Christianity and idealism are incompatible. And as long as you don't see this, you are useless for the battle of the times. Idealism and Christianity are mutually exclusive. Because an idealist idealizes the world, and a Christian dismisses the world. He takes his strength from outside the world, and he comes into the world because it is chaos. The only organizing force, gentlemen, for a Christian in the world is he. Sent from outside the world into this world and to step out from this world and thereby to make it a tolerable place to be. And this goes through your head. It's like a fight against windmills, I always feel. When I talk to you as Christians, you turn out to be idealists, and I turn to you as idealists, you assist me that you have a good heart, and you really have a good heart. Your mind is hopelessly confused. You all confuse the world of space and the eternity of God, the creative power of God. That isn't the body is created the world. That's not a luxury, you see. It means that God is outside the world. If you let this go, you see, and if you think the world itself is divine, then the world in itself is geopolitical rules and diet rules and everything. And then you become the slave of the latest progress of technical science. Because if the world is good, then science is the key to your own life. Can you see this? Because the world then is goodness. And of course we want to be good, therefore we try to decipher the goodness which we are yearning for in four terms of scientific laws. So gentlemen, anyone who says the world is good becomes a slave of science. Because if the world is good, it only takes a scientist to tell you what to do. It's very simple. If the world is good, you come to know what the world does, you act like the world, you're all set. Unfortunately, gentlemen, it isn't that good, as you well know. Everybody in his right instinct knows that the world is not good. It puts on a tremendous veneer of goodness for lipstick. But that's all. The apparition of the world is nice. The advertising, the neon light of the world, but just look behind it and go to the middle world. So gentlemen, this is therefore a big battle. Now the next gentleman position of course is humanism. Versus racism versus nihilism. That is the situation for human society, for the circulation. The church, gentlemen, overcame policy. The science of one world overcame imperialism. No empire today has its own system of longitudes and latitudes. No empire is excluded from the laws of nature. That is. But we say that, see that now inside the one world people, the people who have conquered the empire, tremendous problem that we have chaos for many a sphere. You would say, well, if every man thinks that his own here's a private sky, that's chaos. The paradox of you and my inside today is that only in one word. But without is, and you were participation in this word, it does not give any sign of the real problem of the world, obviously, is that it would have been destroyed itself long ago if it hadn't been constantly recreated. You see, the chaos people, they can't go on. I myself, and they have been all serious thinkers of all time, have forced idealism as not true to fact. The world is not good. No law can be really believed in as good. Just as good. What's good about the thermodynamic law? What's good about death? What's good about illness? Or any doctor has accepted the natural laws of illness and fought them, has resisted them, he has cured them. That's not far into, you see, to science and to the goodness of the world. The doctor says the world is bad, there's cholera. There's the plague. That's not good. That's to be eradicated. You all agree with all these eradications and immunities and vaccinations. Why not? Because the world is so bad that one has to do something against it. Yellow jacket and so on. Doctors, gentlemen, represents a Christian element with relation to nature. And scientists, mere research fellows, represent the other. A physician is a man who the second millennium too has fought nature as being dangerous, as being perilous. You know the difference between a mere research man and a physician. The one cures and the other just examines. Now, in modern science, the chaos hypothesis, the man who says the world is chaos, will immediately have to have the corollary of the curing aspect, of the healing aspect, of man's own activity. So, gentlemen, he will say that we only think and examine in order to cure, in order to heal, in order to prevent chaos, in order to throw ourselves into the breach of chaos. Against it, it's a weapon to think. Gentlemen, one scientist says, I contemplate. The other scientist says, I fight. Now, I can, however, to the third position. As long as the tribes, the many tribes, the many families of men don't intermarry, and you have all the race and color prejudices, you get racism. I mean this. What could I say? I could say polyanthropism, to have a parallel to polytheism, polycosmism, and perhaps you put down polyanthropism. That is, men are men, and they are separate forever. And it's more important to stress the poly than the one. Now, all anthropologists, gentlemen, believe more or less today in polyanthropology. It's the very phrase anthropology, the very sense of name for the science. Started with the idea that there were so many different branches that it was more important to study the difference than the unity. Polyanthropism, I call it racism for brevity's sake, but polyanthropism offers you a parallel to polytheism and polycosmism and may make you patient to believe, gentlemen. As it took the church at least 1,000 years to overcome the many gods, and as it took the scientists 1,000 years to overcome the many empires, and they only have tumbled down during the last 40 years, so I'm quite sure it will take another long period to overcome the polyanthropism in reality. And no fair employment law will this feed up the thing so that we shall see its consolation. Because it's a topic, gentlemen, of the coming 1,000 years of mankind. It's a question whether polyanthropism can be overcome by humanism, which says men in one regardless of race, color, creed, that's humanism, that's freedom. Or by Christianity, which says that man is created out of nothing, as all other things. And therefore must always each time begin with nothingness. That's the moral nihilistic position, which is more Christian than humanistic position. Because the humanistic position, gentlemen, says that man is born as he is. The Christian position says that man is not born as he is. That's ridiculous. He's just not born. So he has to disintegrate into nothingness, and he has to be reborn in the spirit. He has to be made over. And nobody, gentlemen, who never says to himself, Nihil, I deserve to be annihilated, can enter the kingdom of one man. It is impossible for you as you are to form one human society. No one can. The functions of this human society have to be discovered as we go along, and you must be ready to fulfill it for this purpose. You have to break down the walls of your individuality. We are not fixed to enter as we are. Not one is fixed. And the great slogan of the future, therefore, is gentlemen. The sentence of Genesis that God creates out of nothing has to be extended to humanity. Man is created only for the future of the oneness of the human race. If he can accept upon himself the judgment that he is dust, that he is not, that he is annihilated as he finds himself, as his riches, which is language, which is creed and everything. If you are not recreated, gentlemen, very often in your days, in your life, you will die. You will not be able to survive in the future. You will become mechanized, pacified laborers, the EPs, Negro, Germans. And for this purpose, you will be herded into concentration camps or prisons or set away areas. You will not be able to mix anybody labeled, gentlemen, as being something for good, becomes unable in the future to get married. In order to get married, you have to give up part of your individuality. Everybody knows it. Because to marry means to be disarmed, to become developed, to be defenseless, to be recreated. Love, gentlemen, is predicated on annihilation of self. And the humanist has omitted this condition under which we can form one human race. It can only be done in the marriage book. America, gentlemen, remember we said America has two languages, the Christian language, the biblical language, and the Greek language. I've given an example of democracy and peoples. I gave you another example before the other, happiness and salvation. I gave you a third example. Can anybody help me? Now, gentlemen, we have here a very important example of the equality of one man and the metaphor. The metaphor is the biblical idea, the reverse idea. And that's a pretty biblical, a real experience. The metaphor means that you are made open. The non-sexual position is that you are already good. The humanistic position is man is good. The metaphor position is man is nobody. And a little everything. And he can become the right person in the metaphor. Can you find in your notes this list of democracy and people and happiness and salvation? I'll give you a list of other endotones. Revival and election is, by the way, another such topic. There you have one biblical term, and no, you see an idea in election. Now, you come to Germany where you get election and democracy without the idea of people and revival, you see, and you, it doesn't work. Because the overtone isn't there, but with which you understand that democracy can only work among real people. You see, where the Greek term is, the mechanical construction of so many rules of election, but they are different. You have something quite different. You have a common mood, a common destiny, a common prophecy. You have a promise, the promised land of God's country. You see the difference? Now, the same is true, gentlemen, here about meditating God, which is a Christian expression. The man is made whole, God, because he is noble. And the Greek tradition, which says that all men are like you and me. The tradition. Which is only true in abstract, you see, as an idea. Which is an idea of the same world. That's why failure is a good in human life, because it gives any man the experience of annihilation. A man must plunge or must be annihilated. Read a record, the article of Remington in the New Yorker. Certainly, the firstborn in Remington was annihilated in his loyalty, according to the jury. So, gentlemen, today, as you know, the good people tell you nihilists are terrible, and they are all set in their ways. And socially, they are all in disadvantage. So, gentlemen, it is really very good people that they are too good for the future. The condition of entering the future always is to give up to lose. The too good of one time are not the right ones for the future. The condition, gentlemen, of the next millennium is then this experience in every human being that God creates the men of the future out of nothing, more or less. But without some grain of salt of nothingness, you see, the unity of the human race cannot come about. The unity of the human race cannot be postulated out of the men who are as they are, you see. Neither can we acquiesce in racism and polyanthropism to leave people as they are. So we have to study the conditions under which man is recreated. So you see, the humanist says, nothing has to be recreated, everything is good, idealistic. The polyanthropist says, eternal racial antagonism, no intermarriage, segregation. The races are the only entities. The Christian position says, there are tremendous differences. That's the differences are the challenge to find that one way in which men can be reborn. They can only be reborn by taking down those fences. That they have to be taken down in a terrible disarmament race, gentlemen. I always pity the Oxford group people because they call themselves moral rearmament. What we need in the third millennium is moral disarmament. Man has to disarm, you see, of his own qualities. He has to see both things as one he is. Let us have a break. To have one God, the true God of Israel, universal, that has been done by the church, and preached everywhere. To have one world, and to get one society. One society would replace the many families, the many tribes. One world has replaced the many empires. And one God has replaced the many gods. Now, there is the cross of reality, the little construction, which in any moment must represent this effort, is for the church to have seen the four missionary tendencies. Mission to the pagans, there is only a church as long as the gospel is preached, the new covenant. The gospel is always new, and it says the last Negro has been converted, you would still have to convert your own child, because the child is born here. And it's a very difficult thing baptizing in Jews of Israel of Israel. It's more difficult for us than to convert an owner, tiny or Negro, as you well know. So then the mission is an internal form, aspect of the front of the one front of the church, one aspect of the church. The other is memory of the founder, the master, the beginner. Christianity, Christian Union can only exist as long as we know when it started. Jesus is the first man who believed in one God, one world, and one man. And lived it all his life in this oneness. These three things he has written, that's why we have a Trinitarian creed. One man, one God, one world. The Mecca one, therefore, I said Mass. It's a memory of the Father. Your memory is out there on earth. In the inner one, gentlemen, now you understand better why transmission of faith. Because any one individual's faith is intermittent. You have the same word there, intermittent. Again, the same root of omission. Mittent, mission is of course the same Latin word, mittere, to send. To send out power. Missa, Peter Messiah, the power has been sent to you. That has been sent out, the spirit has been sent out. That's the meaning of Missa. It has come down from heaven upon you. Yeah, it's a higher power which enables you to see everything in place and not by reason. And Omish, we say, is a necessity of distinguishing the world from God. Not the whole world is God. That's the monastic, the ascetic implication of any belief, by the way, in any living faith that is necessary. So, gentlemen, we said wherever these four things are, there is a church. It is not enough to say that where the name of Christ is mentioned, there is a church. It is not enough that you, any propagation, any propaganda is already a Christian attitude. Without the connection with the memory of the founder, it isn't. There must be some asceticism, some resignation of worldly success. Why, gentlemen? Because success is at its highest when it coincides with one time, one generation only. Nobody who cares for the unity of the Christian era can be quite successful in his own time. He must give some amount of energy to the continuity. That's just a squaring that your accounts, you see. If you live only to your own time, there's nothing left to be squeezed. There's no energy invested in your connection with the past or your connection with the future. A Christian gentleman cannot build the kingdom of heaven if he doesn't show any interest, vital interest, in connecting his own time with the past and the future. That costs strength. Therefore, gentlemen, no Christian can be fully successful. And that I mean by omission. If you follow in every respect the latest fashion, you belong to the latest fashion and you pass out with the latest fashion. You have to detract from the fashion of the times some ounce of your money and energy and blood and heartbeat in order to give this for linking up with people before you and after you. This is very simple. That's why Mother's Day is such a terrible thing. Because mothers cost nothing to love them, you see. Love is the most inexpensive thing in the world. And to make it into a commercial thing of the day should make you vomit. To spend money on your connection with the previous generation, you see, makes the whole thing into a hoax. Your real contribution to your mother, your relation to your mother, is obviously feeding her love and her affection and what she meant when you brought you into the world. And that cannot be done by telegram or Western Union, happy birthday to you. We watch today's further disintegration of your relation to the... Our personal individual decision, anyways. Wherever you have a wish that is the willing
to spread this what you hold to be true and put it in the heart of others to help them. That is the church, then, better than any other, any official definition of it. They usually admit one or the other. But one of the definitions of the church are really bad or foreign, because they never listen to the experience that they describe something for, that they see it on paper. Whenever this transgender, as it has got anything to do with the ordinary four attributes of the church, as to what we have to do with the go ahead, what does it want to know? One holy chapter and the Son. That's the other story. Yeah. And why don't we ask our great mission? What? Why not communicate the apostolic promise? So that's one. Okay. That's the vision of God. That's the one that is created by the against all the fear. The authority is to see the outside and then create it. This is holy. So, yeah. And this is covenant. Because every man is saying covenant. Our story is born holy and covenant.
What is covenant?
Over the borders. Over the borders. So it is not any private affair, you see. It's the affair of all men. It has to be, it's transmitted wherever it goes. And it is only by catholicity, because through its catholicity, the deficiencies of the individual are always covered. That is the mission of the mission of God, which is considered as a final word. Perhaps if you work with theologians, I would like to use this word now. What is meant by the remission of sins is the issue of forgiveness and fellowship. So no, there's that whole matter in the remission of sins. And you can
Long ago.
important as is the progress by the nations. Most of the other ones say progress, and the Europe says by the nations, then most of the rest. Progress is made by this country who has made progress by the revolution. Industrial revolution, technical revolution, kinematic revolution, civil revolution. This means, you see, that this can change. Now let's find out how mission is a mission produced. By the missionary is made by the nation. Not all. How is a revolution achieved? By the revolutionary's name, somebody else. So gentlemen, the world is made more aggressive. The church has been made one and is made one by power. That is, he who carries the cross cannot attack. He tells the story of a missionary who went to the Eskimos and lived with them 16 years and always tried to preach the gospel. And after 16 years, one day after the meal, the young Eskimo went out with him and said, "Father, who was this man?" And that was the first ray of hope, the first success of this mission after 16 years. That the man asks himself, you see, who was this man? Just, otherwise no mission is possible. All mission is based on the spontaneity of those, you see, to whom the mission is for. It's quite the opposite, gentlemen, it's only in their pockets. The communists attack, as you were. All revolutionaries, have this spontaneity very much in themselves. You see? And the other one, they are blessed by the blessings of the revolution. Very much conferred. So gentlemen, the scientist has an active mind. The Christian has a passive mind. The highest stage of Christianity is passion. Good Friday. For this reason. Passion is the sense of passivity. And the highest stage in American history is revolution. And Russia is setting on the course. And France, 14th of July, and England, 5th of November, always the day in which the revolution is made. Something active is done. And in the Christian church, something is spent upon. That's better. But the reason is, gentlemen, that one God can only be the mean by people who wish and revelation to God, not mediated by the men who write them. But one word can be organized, technically, by patent and copyright and anything. You don't care who builds the story. I don't wish to build a story, but I wish to write it. That my relation to God must be my own religion. You cannot missionize one and gospelize God. If you don't allow the man to believe in God himself, then you can very well organize the world by selling tickets in a railroad. And the world has not done nothing to build the railroad. The relation of the church is based on a direct relation of every man to this point of the cross. The relation of one word, however, to you and me, is not at all based on you and me having any personal relation to this world. How do we participate in one word? Why do we participate in one word? That you do not know, that by idealism. Idealism, you see, does not realize that the world has no center from which you and I participate in it. All relations to God are your and my relations. And we must stand in the center. Nobody who hasn't suffered from the difference between his humanity and his divinity knows who God is. But anybody is in the world already active, walking around. How is this better? How is the one out of the participate in the world? Let's see. to participate in shelter, to participate in using here this electric light. How does it come to you? As members of a group, as members of a settlement, as members of your nation, the inside by which name only indirectly is connected with, can be connected with the world, is that it belongs to a nation whose language he understands and in which he participates. Most people who write and speak are only not in the center of their responsibility. They talk, they gossip, they practice the language of their editorial followers. And he ends the process of it and says, so gentlemen, what I need to say is, there is no center for the world. This point goes out in US front of the hierarchy. There's always rules. Science, for example, attraction. The world is organized, gentlemen, in an abstract manner, not in a personal manner. That's for you hard to understand. That to take it down as something that's to be meditated upon this much later. The world is never organized in a person, but always in an abstract way. Every many of this book can be notated by someone else. The important thing is, gentlemen, that the outside does not appear as something to be omitted, but as nature, as something to get reorganized. Nature. Many examples to this have acquired nature. The himself to be sure natural. The claim of this whole second millennium is that the nations want to be one with nature, to put nation and nature on all fours, is the idea of this era. And any revolution is achieved so that what you are by birth might appear to be natural. Now, you say, well, isn't it? You are so deeply immersed in your own nature that you do not know that when you are given the name, face, or frame, that you are not natural. Names, as we already know, are not natural. They are historical. But men try to forget all this, what makes him just nationalist. And he says, oh, let me just be a natural man. So, gentlemen, he has to achieve this identification of nation and nature by religions, by progress, by machinery, by all kinds of gadgets, in which he becomes more and more natural, the more refrigerator and power he has. That is the main contradiction. We have now reached the zenith of naturalness. Everybody whom I talk to says, I'm a minister of sex, a piece of nature. And when I see how this man is dressed and how he moves, there's not one inch of naturalness around him. You see? That's very strange here. Even the ladies wear glasses, pardon me. That's not natural. That's scientific. We are all scientific men, and we all pose as natural men. Very strange how we can do it. There is nothing natural about us. We have no beards, we are clean shaven. Mr. Gillette has planned. Is this a triumph of nature? You know, Jews and Greek Christians take it very, very seriously to our shaving. They say we are all bound to go to heaven because God gave us a beard, and to shave is against nature. And they are very serious in this. As you know, the Greek priest in the Greek Orthodox Church must wear a beard because he, although he looks heavenly, he says that's how God wanted him to be. I speak to my created nature. And they are much more faithful about nature than you and I are. Shaving is an absolute unnatural action, isn't it? It hurts. Now I have to stop here, gentlemen, but I hope that things are now. You can see immediately that in the end of the next drop, we have taken the progress and effect. So watch any child that they say goes up in the mechanized world, the world is mechanical. So that what has been the goal, gentlemen, of the grandfathers is the background of your children. They take that for granted. What is life? What is the economic? They are blasé. Just as 100 years ago your fathers began to say, well, Christians, of course, but what of it? You see? So your children will say, mechanization, of course, but what of it? Now you have taken another goal. I put a question mark there. Where do these fewer people go?
for mechanization.